Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we are joined today by Sam Rainwright, who is the National Co-Convener of Socialist Alliance. And we have Sam here today to have a bit of a discussion about, you know, following the death of Queen Elizabeth, we have seen, like, you know, a lot of this adoration within the sort of mainstream sort of media. And I guess it's sort of raising, I guess, a bit of this kind of discussion about the whole kind of role of the monarchy within Australian politics. And I think we have Sam here to have a bit of a critical kind of discussion that we're not necessarily going to be having in the sort of mainstream sort of media. So, yeah, good morning, Sam.
Yeah, good morning to you. Thanks for the opportunity.
So, I guess to start off with my first question, there has been a lot of adoration for the role of Queen Elizabeth II and the royal family following her death. And of course, we are being told now by, you know, a lot of the mainstream sort of news outlets, you know, from the capitalist sort of press, you know, that now is not the time to criticise the monarchy. Why do you think this is nonsense from any kind of progressive kind of standpoint?
Well, I think it's nonsense because what we've witnessed over the last week is an absolutely full tilt attempt by all, you know, pretty much all of our mainstream media, including, I should say, the ABC, to essentially build up and venerate the institution of the British royal family. So it's not like this has just been treated as, you know, the dignified private funeral of an elderly woman, or even a dignified state funeral. No, this has been turned into a massive media event, and you could not say that the media coverage of the death of Queen Elizabeth and the succession of King Charles, you could not say that that has just been a case of news reporting. It hasn't been reporting. It's been a very conscious process of trying to construct and build up the institution, and it's all about the institution. So it's been totally disingenuous for people who support that institution to say, oh, well, now's not the time. You know, the way it often gets put is, oh, but, you know, Queen Elizabeth was a grandmother too, and, you know, she did a lot of good works and all this sort of stuff. But whatever the truth of that, of so-called good works or good, you know, good intentions of Queen Elizabeth, the point is that this is being treated as an ideological event, promotion event, by our media, and as such, we have a perfect right to respond, and it's the perfect time to do it. And, you know, I don't think I'll be telling your listeners anything they don't know already, but the very notion that you would have an unelected, divine birthright figurehead of our state runs in complete contradiction with the most basic and fundamental democratic principles. That's just obvious, and we have a right to say it.
I was going to go into sort of another question before I go into sort of the other one. And I guess I wanted to hear, I guess, some of your comments on, I guess, the kind of actual kind of legacy of the British kind of royal family. Because there's been a kind of lot of commentary about, you know, the so-called good works of Queen Elizabeth. And, you know, you can't blame, you know, you can't attribute, you know, the crimes of British colonialism to the royal family and so on. And, of course, yeah, and it's quite clear that when it comes to the death of Queen Elizabeth, it's been looked at a lot differently from those who are within the global south. And I kind of wanted to hear, what is your sort of comments on some of that?
Yes, well, you know, this sort of defence of the Queen and the royal family along the lines of, oh, they've tried to do good works and change it from within and all this sort of stuff. I mean, let's bear in mind that, you know, Queen Elizabeth was only in a position to do these so-called good works by virtue of an institution that she was born into. The institution is the question at hand. I mean, my grandmother died at the age of 96, and she was caring and kind and considerate as well, but no one was asked to, you know, stand for a minute silence at a football game when she passed away. Why? What's by virtue of the fact that she was descended from European peasants, not European nobility. Now, you know, there's no doubt that the outpouring around Queen Elizabeth II especially in a country like Australia and Britain, it's not entirely manufactured. I mean, there's a genuine, it's sort of mixed in, I hesitate to use the term, but for boomers in particular, it's kind of mixed in with an element of nostalgia for their youth. Remember that Queen Elizabeth came to the throne, you know, in her youth, at a time broadly coinciding with the time of rising prosperity in the global north, including for working people in the global north. So people sort of, so there is a layer of the population who think about these things less critically, who just sort of see the passing of Queen Elizabeth a bit like a pop star from their youth. You know, they conflate Queen Elizabeth with just sort of continuity, the sunshine of their youth and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, that's a real thing when we have to understand that and relate to it and not just, you know, dump shit on such people for being sort of naive or ignorant. But at the same time, we have to recognise and certainly not silent the voices of those people who see embodied by the British royal family the violence and dispossession that was suffered by them. And I mean we see that, you know, equally in the outpouring of people both in the global south and people in Ireland. And you know, as Irish patriot and trade unionist and socialist James Connolly said, paraphrasing it here, but he said, you know, he was talking about King George V ascending to the throne, and he said, we won't hold King George V responsible for the crimes of ancestors, for the crimes of his ancestors, providing he relinquishes the royal title and authority that he gets, by virtue of his ancestors. So, you know, people can't have it both ways. They can't say, oh, the Queen's not responsible for everything that was done in her name in the past. Oh, but she still gets to hang on to this title and the wealth and all that sort of stuff that comes with that role that was actually an instrumental, both materially and ideologically, in spearheading both the subjugation of Ireland and then the British Empire. It's got to be one or the other, and that's, you know, they get caught, sort of defenders of the British royal family get caught up with their own contradiction on that one.
Well, the next kind of question is, and I think this is sort of an interesting sort of area to kind of explore, because okay, so we're living under capitalism kind of today. Now, one of the sort of amazing dreams that sort of that capitalism kind of brought to the fore, I guess, you know, looking from the ideals of the French Revolution, you know, it was this whole idea of actually ending the rule of monarchs, you know, ending the rule of kings and queens, to be able to actually live in a world where, you know, we would enjoy more of the full worth of labour. I mean, that's the idea of socialism, but it was also a certain sense a progressive ideal of capitalism following the transition from feudalism to capitalism. But I guess so in that sense, the monarchy is, you know, it's an institution that's more or less a relic of an old relic of a far gone era. And I guess, why do you think under capitalism today, especially more in the Commonwealth sort of countries, like Australia, where we speaking today, why do you think it is still symbolically kind of maintained as an institution?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good question, because it's, you know, it's easy enough just to sort of pour scorn on the British royal family as an outdated, you know, bizarre institution and this sort of wacky relic of feudalism just sort of tacked on like a bit of tinsel to the side of the contemporary or modern state. And just to reduce it to sort of pure symbolism or just, you know, its value as, you know, celebrity pop culture distraction, that sort of stuff. And it, you know, forms all those functions, but there's something actually much deeper going on. And I think you raise a really important point. What is its modern function? All the more so too, because people talked about, you know, Queen Elizabeth modernising the institution of the monarchy. And, you know, of course, there are plenty of modern capitalist states that are republics. So, you know, it's not an indispensable feature of a modern capitalist state. So why has it continued in Britain, Canada, Australia in particular? And, you know, there's specific historical reasons why that's the case, but I think it is interesting to look at what function does it perform. And I think there's a few things. One is that it continues to give legitimacy to the idea that some people are born to rule and others are not. And that remains true not in the same way as it was under feudalism, but that remains true in modern capitalist society as it was under feudalism. I mean, if you look at the massive disparity of wealth and the growing gap growing wealth gap in a country like Australia, what that bears out is, despite the sort of the capitalist dream that we can all make it to the top if we try hard enough, the vast majority of really wealthy capitalists inherit their wealth and pass their wealth on. And so we still live in a society that is fundamentally defined by the lottery of birth. And so the British royal family, you know, continues to play a certain ideological function of legitimising or justifying that. Then the other thing as well is that the British royal family has been used to try and create this aura or notion that there is, you know, this aspects or functions of the state that sit above politics, that are beyond reproach, that are beyond debate, that are, if you like, almost God-given, and that politicians come and go, but there are some things that remain eternal, you know, and unchanging. And that's true, you know, in terms of the way the state functions. And I guess the British royal family is used to sort of just kind of symbolise that in human form, you know. And you think about it in context of the last, like I said at the start of the interview, that people kind of remember Queen Elizabeth, you know, particularly, you know, people over the age of 60, for instance. You know, they think of her, you know, her coming to the throne coinciding with the sunshine of their youth. But she's the latter part of her reign, if you'll excuse me for using the term, has coincided with neoliberalism in Britain and in Australia. And so that has actually meant, you know, people's a growth in insecurity in people's lives, less secure work, higher, you know, privatisation, contracting out, deregulation, a massive increase in the cost of housing, and that in turn has in fact injected greater instability and volatility into our politics, and it's seen people's identification with mainstream politics and the so-called two-party system decline. And their cynicism with politics decline. And the number of people who are described as rusted on Liberal or Labour voters has been declining. It's much more common for governments to be kicked out of only one term. And that's because of the pain being inflicted on people by neoliberalism. And so it's harder for both Labour and Liberal, for instance, in this country to build consensus. And so you see that volatility. So in that sense, the Queen and this sort of permanency, all these politicians may be scoundrels and they come and go, that sort of stuff, but you've still got the good old Queen, you know, just at the helm, you know, steadying the ship, or, you know, all that kind of thing. So I think that's the sort of function the profoundly problematic function that the British royal family has played in the context of modern capitalism. And I think you can actually say that Queen Elizabeth and the people around her, you know, very consciously have sought to fashion the royal family into that function, you know, to perform that function. So in that sense, you know, we really need to clear that away so we can actually have a proper discussion about how to move forward in this society, socially, politically, democratically, and so on.
And I guess that gets into the next kind of question, which is, I guess, following the death of Queen Elizabeth, due to rules within our Australian Parliament, being a constitutional monarchy, every single parliamentarian now has to kind of swear allegiance to the new king. And I guess this has sort of raised discussions from progressive MPs from parties such as the Greens about, which is, you know, asking the question, why do we have to pledge allegiance to an unelected monarch before we are allowed to do anything in Parliament, before we're able to advocate for anything progressive? And I guess, how does this sort of raise the case, you know, for Australia becoming a republic?
Well, I mean, the reason MPs have to do it is because we're a constitutional monarchy, you know, and that's what's got to be changed. And so it's, you know, swearing allegiance to the monarch is just the thing you have to do if you want to take your seat in Parliament. So that's the gist of the problem. I think though, you know, we should absolutely use this moment to raise a discussion about a transition to an Australian Republic. But do it in a way that pushes the envelope. Because we know, as I mentioned before, you know, there are perfectly stable, conservative, capitalist republics in the world. And, you know, in a country like France, for instance, where they did away with the monarchy a long time ago, the sort of the ideological bullshit that politicians gravitate to justify any reactionary, horrible thing they're doing is they invoke republican values. You know, everything is shitty in France. If the politicians want to do, just like in Australia, you know, they talk about, oh, we're doing it in the national interest. In France, they talk about, oh, you know, this is in line with republican values. You know, it's a republican value. It's just being ends up meaning whatever you want it to mean. So it's very important then that in that context, and given people's cynicism with politics as well, is that we don't just advocate for a minimalist republic where we just, you know, replace, you know, the British royal family with an appointed, you know, president who performs exactly the same roles. Instead, I think we should be trying to advance an argument for republic based on treaty and with Bill of Rights, as a starting point, at least. There's a lot more we can advocate for as well. But a transition to republic should precisely mean something more than just a bit of symbolic change at the top. Because that will just make people more cynical and pissed off with politics. And it's why the Republic referendum back in 1999 was defeated, you know, because people just saw it as just a little symbolic sort of trick being pulled by politicians. And it's got to be something more profound than that. And that's why, equally, and this is more important than any, than what goes into a Republic, is that it's got to be born out of a popular process. So, if you look at the kind, you know, even though it was defeated, the referendum for a new constitution in Chile is a little pointer. It wasn't, we can talk about why that happened, but the sort of change we need is to be born out of a republic that is born out of popular will. So I think we do need some sort of mass process of engagement in which popular demands are allowed to be formed and then are embedded in the referendum for change.
And I guess that kind of does lead, I mean, you sort of covered some of the parts, I guess, of the next kind of question, but I guess I want to sort of, ask a bit of a concluding kind of question, I guess, you know, from the perspective of being, I guess, a socialist, I mean, what would you sort of see, I guess, as more a sort of ideal form of Australia becoming a republic? Because given that, you know, there is clearly a debate amongst both the left and right on a republic, for example, I mean, Malcolm Turnbull, for example, supports the idea of Australia becoming a republic, but, you know, his version of what the republic means is very different from, say, what Lydia Thorpe from the Greens thinks should have a republic. And I guess another aspect is, I guess, more sort of elaboration, I guess, on how, you know, how a transition to Australia becoming a republic needs to kind of respect the sovereignty and rights of our First Nations people.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I think that's why the cornerstone of progress towards a republic has to be treaty. And treaty that respects that sovereignty was never ceded and that embeds a process of real land rights. I mean, if we don't do that, then it's not worth shit, basically. I mean, that's got to be the starting point, both in terms of delivering a measure of justice to Indigenous people, but also, you know, until we're honest about our history, then we're not going to be able to make an honest future. So that's got to be a starting point. Like I said before, the process has got to be driven by popular engagement as well. So it can't be done by technocrats at the top. If we're going to transition to a republic, then we do need some sort of, you know, process of, you know, popular conventions or such as have happened in other countries, something like that actually really make it very clear that this is a process that's been driven by popular will. I think also then it needs to, you know, we need to embed things like respect for the environment and civil rights, some sort of code or charter of civil rights as well, so that we can begin to edge our way towards grasping the fact that real democracy means extending democracy to the economy. We need the kind of constitution that actually that makes it an obligation of the state, for instance, this is one example, but makes it an obligation of the state to guarantee access to dignified and affordable housing as a human right for everyone. That's the kind of thing that also needs to be embedded in the constitution of the republic that we need.
Alright, well, thank you very much, Sam. I think this has been a very good kind of discussion, and I think, you know, there's good at these. Quite, one thing I'd like to note is we have, Green Left has actually published kind of a lot of coverage, in the kind of, past week on, you know, with lots of commentary on this question around the role of the monarchy in Australian society, and also criticism of the kind of mainstream sort of line of almost kind of uncritical adoration of Queen Elizabeth. So, yeah, I definitely recommend to our listeners that you check out some of the articles that have been printed, published on greenleft.org.au. And I'd like to also thank again, Sam, for joining us on our program.